Starting Overdrive. Real stories of starting over with Red Seaton.
Hey everyone, welcome to Starting Overdrive, where you'll hear real stories of starting over from real people of all walks of life. I'm your host, Reg Seaton. Welcome to part 3 of the Starting Overdrive Turning Point series called My 5-Year Recovery Journey. In this new segment of the podcast called Turning Points, I focus on significant, life-changing events directly connected to the process of starting over. Events, or turning points, that alter who we are, force us to change direction in life, and let go of everything we once knew. This segment is an exploration into life-defining, irreversible turning points that rock us to the very core of our being and force us to accept change whether we like it or not. It's through these irreversible turning points that we truly learn who we are on the deepest level, what we can handle in life, the true power of the human spirit, and who we were meant to become. On many levels, who we thought we were before these major life-changing events was only preparing us for who we're supposed to be after the turning point. The following story is an extension of the most important, irreversible turning point that changed my life forever. This episode is a continuation of part 2, in which I detailed the day I woke up from a coma in 1985, after I was hit by a car while walking home with friends and left clinging to life on the side of the Bedford Highway in Halifax, Nova Scotia, Canada, where I grew up. This story details the aftermath of an accident with graphic words that may produce traumatic imagery and be too much for the sensitive listener. Listener discretion is advised. After being rushed to the hospital in an ambulance and into surgery to save my life, I spent a week in a coma, again, clinging to life, as doctors and family wondered in desperation whether I'd wake up. In part 2, I shared my experience of being in a coma, what it was like, and my memories of being aware in a state of unconscious awareness. The prognosis of my condition evolved during that week, with doctors indicating that I may wake up but suffer severe brain damage. Fortunately, and miraculously, I did wake up after 8 full days in a coma and several unique and unbelievable experiences in a coma, which I shared in part 2. In fact, this story begins immediately after waking up from a coma during the first week of recovery, over a week after my accident. I began a 5-year journey of recovery that saw me fighting for my life all over again, many times. The first week after waking up from a week-long coma in the hospital, it was as if time slowed to a snail's pace. It was disorienting, but also rejuvenating. I was awake, and I was alive in the Victoria General Hospital in downtown Halifax, Nova Scotia, on the east coast of Canada. The year was 1985. I was hit by a car on May 18th, a Saturday, underwent life-saving reconstructive surgery in the early hours of the morning, slipped into a coma, and woke up 8 days later on May 26th. The winter of 1985 was unusually cold. In fact, record-breaking. The entire eastern seaboard of North America was hit with an exceptionally cold winter, and one of the worst in recorded history. It was also the same year Mikhail Gorbachev became leader of the Soviet Union, Michael Jordan was named Rookie of the Year in the NBA, and Prince Harry was born to Princess Diana and Prince Charles. Interestingly, 1985 was also the same year British scientists discovered a hole in the Earth's ozone layer. The comic strip Calvin and Hobbes made its debut. The Color Purple debuted at the box office. And the very first .com domain name was registered in 1985. The best way I can describe my first week after waking up from a coma, it was like I had just woken up from a deep sleep. I was groggy and oblivious to what was happening around me, but content, happy, and at peace. As I mentioned in the previous episode, I had spent a week in a coma, a state in which time was irrelevant. Now that I was awake, and now that time mattered in the waking world, it took me a long while to adjust to the fact that time was everything, to everyone, that time governed a lot of what we do each day, from second to second, minute to minute, day to day, year to year. In a coma, there were no classifications or constraints of time. Everything was just the now. That first week in the hospital, I simply enjoyed the moment. It was like I was still in a coma. It's hard for me to articulate this properly, to describe what it was like, because to me, 1 minute I'm walking home late at night with friends, talking and laughing, everything's fine. The next minute, I'm waking up in the hospital over a week later, broken, injured, and a completely different person than who I was a week earlier. Looking back now, and really seeing this analogy for the first time, in trying to describe what it felt like, it was as if someone took your spirit while you were sleeping, the essence of who you are, and put it in a completely different body, a broken body, that looks like you, but isn't you, or should I say, no longer you. And you wake up the next day thinking and expecting you're the same person, but you quickly realize that identity, the person you once were, is gone forever. That's exactly what it was like. Surprisingly, though, I didn't have many questions for doctors or nurses. As I mentioned in the previous episode, it was as if I already knew what happened deep down at the core of my being. A deep knowing from a place of energy or spirituality, a place of spiritual identity. I remember a profound moment not long after waking up from a coma. It was a moment of recognition that I'm truly grateful for to this day. In fact, it was a moment of choice, acceptance, surrender, and freedom that allowed me to move forward. When I woke up from a coma, doctors and nurses were in and out of my room, asking me several questions. "Reggie, do you know where you are?" they asked. "Do you know what happened?" Of course, from a real-world standpoint, I didn't know what happened. They had to tell me. I didn't know why I was in the hospital. My family was there as well to help fill in the gaps. The way they were telling me was if they were trying to soften the blow, to soften the severity of what happened so I wouldn't be completely devastated. As they asked me questions, also telling me that I was hit by a car, filling in the gaps, I remember a powerfully reflective, insightful feeling come over me as I received their information. I wasn't devastated by the news. I wasn't distraught or upset. In fact, at the time, my family members were more upset than I was. It was an instinctive feeling of instantaneous knowing that who I was before my accident, the guy I was before being hit by a car, he was gone forever. When you hear people say, "Oh, my life flashed before my eyes," it was remarkably similar. It was an instant feeling of letting go on the deepest level of being. As they were telling me what happened, how long I'd been in a coma, and the state of my condition, I knew that guy was gone, forever. In that moment, I remember thinking to myself, "Don't waste any time trying to get that guy back. He's gone. You only have the now forward." From that deeper place of knowing, from being in a coma, and a place of spiritual identity, I already knew he was gone before anyone told me. Like I said, it was a powerful moment of acceptance, surrender, and freedom. But more importantly, the most powerful choice I've ever made in my life. A choice to not spend my energy trying to regain the person I was before my accident, but instead embrace the fact that he was gone. I was starting over. I was surrendering to the now. It was this moment of instantaneous acceptance, surrender, and choice that allowed me to embrace the next 5 years of my life, my recovery. The first major turning point after waking up from a coma happened 3 to 4 days later. It was a turning point that emphatically punctuated the severity of what happened to me, the seriousness and the permanency. The first week out of a coma was one of joy and happiness. I was elated to be alive. I was content and at peace from a place of full surrender. I wasn't angry or bitter. In fact, I was all smiles. I recall being wheeled out of my room in a wheelchair, with family members by my side. My mother and father were there. I was all smiles and joking with the nurses. But I could sense something was off. Something wasn't quite right. The nurses weren't smiling back. They wouldn't even look at me. It was like they were afraid to look at me. I could hear whispers behind me, as if they all knew something I didn't. It was an odd, awkward feeling of foreshadowing. Looking back now, they knew what was coming. They knew my life was about to change forever by what the doctors had to say. To this day, I'm still fascinated by what happened next. I was wheeled into a room where a doctor was waiting for me to arrive. I thought it was simply a routine checkup. It was anything but routine. The doctor asked me, "You can see me, right?" I said, "Sure, I can see you." He then covered my right eye and asked me if I could still see him. "Absolutely," I replied. He then covered my left eye and asked me again if I could see him. I was silent. I didn't know what I was looking at. Everything was black. Darkness. Was I back in a coma? "Reggie, can you see me?" he asked again. "No, I can't see you," I replied. "What do you see?" he probed. "Darkness. I can't see anything." He then removed his hand from my left eye, and I could see again. And he said, "That's because you're blind in your right eye." I remember the moment like it was yesterday. "Oh my God," I gasped. "You're right." It's as if the entire world shifted, spun back and forth, and came into clearer, sharper focus. I was stunned, speechless. He went on to tell me that because of the impact of my head hitting the ground when I was hit by a car, a bone near my temple inside my skull had snapped and severed the optic nerve of my eye in half. And because the optic nerve is an appendage of the brain, it can't be surgically repaired. It was permanent. Again, I was stunned. In shock. Not because I was blind in one eye. That much was obvious. I was more surprised by the fact that I had spent the last 3 to 4 days awake, talking to people, thinking and believing I could see out of two eyes, that I actually had to be told I was blind in one eye. It still fascinates me to this day how the brain compensated for the loss of sight. Again, like waking up from a coma and knowing immediately, instantaneously, that the old me was gone forever, and not dwelling on trying to get that guy back, I quickly accepted the fact that I was blind in one eye. Instantaneously accepted, as soon as the doctor told me, and I had that moment of recognition. This may sound strange to some of you listening. You may be asking, how in the world did he accept these things so quickly? It's hard to explain. Whenever I think of those moments of instant acceptance, my blind eye, waking up from a coma, knowing that I'm different, those things you can never get back, I am reminded of the power of choice, how powerful choices truly are in moving forward from adversity. My blind eye was something so permanent that it simply didn't make logical sense to attach any negative emotion to the fact that I couldn't see anymore out of that eye. There was nothing I could do. It was irreversible. It had already happened, and I was forced to accept it, whether I liked it or not. Feeling bad about it was irrelevant and served no purpose. And if feeling bad didn't make logical sense, why would I then choose to feel bad? The opposite of feeling bad is feeling good, and it only made sense to choose to feel good about it. My reaction, when it really sunk in that I couldn't see out of my right eye, was one of acknowledgement and curiosity. After closing my eye a few times, covering my good eye to really see that I was indeed blind in that eye, I remember saying, "Oh, okay, well, that's interesting. There's nothing I can do about it." I've never really given it much thought. I've always been grateful that I can see out of one eye. Others were more shocked and devastated than I was. My family, doctors, and nurses were surprised that I didn't take the news harder, or that I wasn't shattered by the news. Again, I was simply more focused on making the best of what I had, rather than dwelling on something I could never get back. But that was the first major turning point of many that I'd be forced to confront over the next few years. After 2 weeks, I was released from the hospital. It was the week of June 10th, 1985. Interestingly, if you listened to part one of this series, I mentioned that the month before I was hit by a car, April of that year, Coca-Cola had introduced the world to New Coke, which was one of the worst product rollouts in history. Well, the same week I was released from hospital, Coca-Cola had announced they were bringing back Classic Coke, their old 99-year-old formula. That's how bad a taste New Coke left with the public in 1985. When I was released from the hospital, even back then I remember thinking to myself how oddly quick it was for me to be going home, especially given the extent of trauma my body had experienced. I couldn't possibly be okay after what I'd been through. Something about my release didn't feel right. It seemed too good to be true, and it was. The following 6 months set the stage for what I'd experience in the next 4.5 years. I was young, healthy, and in really good shape. Although I knew deep down that who I was before my accident, I couldn't get that guy back, he was gone, I still tried to resume life as I knew it. As my head trauma healed, I tried to become active that summer. By the end of the summer, I was able to run and play light outdoor basketball, at least go through the motions. That was the first sign something was wrong. I remember it like it was yesterday. We were playing at an elementary school basketball court, outdoors. You know the ones where the baskets are a few feet shorter, made for little kids? The ones where the average guy could dunk on the smaller baskets and feel like Michael Jordan. It was Duke Danville Elementary School in the community of Fairview, named after the famous French naval military leader whose fleet was sent to Nova Scotia in 1746 from France to recapture the fortress of Louisbourg in Cape Breton, which had been taken over by British forces prior to the American Revolutionary War. I remember running down the court with the ball, only to feel a sharp, excruciating, cutting pain in my knee that I'd never felt before, and then a sudden pop that knocked me to the ground. As I thrashed on the ground, clutching my leg, I noticed that my knee had swollen to twice its normal size. I could barely walk. I hobbled off the court and was done for the day. I went home first, got my father, and went straight to the hospital. It was the last place I wanted to be, but it was comforting in this new time of need. Even to this day, after all that I've been through, I'm not afraid of going to the hospital when something goes wrong. I'm more like, let's go and get it over with as quickly as possible. Because, the truth be told, that's why hospitals exist. There's no better place to be. Upon examination by a doctor, my knee had popped out of place. It was even more swollen than before. What's fascinating to me now today, as much as it was back then too, is that the doctor examined my knee, knew the problem, grabbed hold of my leg behind my knee at the top of my calf, told me to brace for some pain, and gave 2 forcefully hard tugs forward. And just like that, he snapped my knee back into place. It was incredible. And just like that, the pain and swelling started to subside. The next day, after icing my knee overnight, I was able to walk again with a bit of a limp. Recovery was that quick. I didn't think it was a big problem because I could walk again with little to no pain. A few days later, I was back on the basketball court to give it another try. Keep in mind, I was 16 years old. At that age, you really do feel like you're invincible. After going through the accident, the coma, a brief recovery, I simply wanted to get on with life. And, you know, be 16. That was my mindset. This new knee problem was more of a distraction to moving forward. An annoying obstacle, if you will. So, I ended up doing something, with the help of my best friend, that I can't believe I did, but it worked, for a while. While playing another pickup basketball game, this time running up the court, I felt another sharp, unbearable pain. My knee buckled, and I fell to the ground. The same thing happened to the same knee. My knee popped out of place. Once again, I was writhing on the ground in pain, clutching my knee. This time, wondering what the hell was wrong, knowing that something was wrong, but not wanting to believe it. I got to my feet and hobbled off the court for a second time, knowing that my knee was out of place. The last thing I wanted to do was go to the hospital, again, and waste the entire day sitting, waiting for hours. That's when the idea came to me. Recalling what the doctor did days earlier to put my knee back in place, I asked my best friend Doug to grab hold of my knee, behind the knee, at the top of the calf, and pull hard forward on my knee with a sudden tug. He pulled, hard, but nothing happened. He tried again, nothing. "Pull harder," I said. "One more time, pull." This time he pulled, hard, jerking my entire body forward. And, snap, it worked. He popped my knee back in place. It's interesting to think back now. The relief was immediate. My knee would pop back into place, and I'd simply have to wait a bit for the swelling to subside. I could walk again within minutes. It was a trick that served me well temporarily. Over the next few weeks, my knee popped out of place more frequently. It went from once every few days to almost a daily occurrence, multiple times a day. And each time, my best friend would be there to pop it back in place. Wherever we were, wherever it happened, I'd sit down on a bench or the ground, hold my leg out, and he'd pop my knee back in place. It only took a few seconds. Within those few weeks, my other knee started to do the same thing. Both my knees were popping out of place. This time, though, the second knee was much harder to fix. I couldn't pop it back into place. I had to wait for swelling to subside and for the joint to slowly fix itself and realign. There were times when both knees popped out of place at the same time. As a result, it was becoming difficult to walk. My knees weren't getting any better. In fact, they were getting worse by the day. I couldn't put it off any longer. I had to get my knees looked at by a doctor. As it turned out, after having x-rays and an exploratory scope procedure, I had torn the anterior cruciate ligament in my right leg, my ACL, with cartilage also damaged and torn in my left leg. I needed surgery to repair both my knees. They were severely damaged in the accident when I was hit by the car. Obviously, when the car hit my body, the force of momentum, the speed of the car, blew out my knees. I was looking at months to get the surgeries, rehabilitate my knees, and then recover. Deep down, I knew something was wrong the very first time my knee popped out of place. I didn't want to admit it. Instead, I tried to live as normal of a life as I could for as long as I could. Somehow, I knew I'd be going back to the hospital. Almost immediately after getting my knees looked at and planning for surgery, I began to experience sudden headaches. Light headaches. Intermittent, they'd come and go, but they were noticeable. I've never been one to suffer from headaches or migraines, even to this day. At first, I didn't think too much of it because the headaches were mild and sporadic. I simply thought they were a byproduct of my head injury, that they came with the territory, so to speak. Within a few days, they became more severe, intense, with dizziness and nausea. Whenever a headache came on, I had to lay down or risk falling down. Then the headaches became more constant, more intense, to a point that I couldn't hold food down any longer. I was vomiting. I remember being at my sister's house on the outskirts of town, a tiny fishing village in Nova Scotia called Herring Cove on the Atlantic Ocean, at the mouth of the Halifax Harbor, a beautiful location where my father had also spent time as a young man. In fact, my sister's house was once my father's aunt's house. Her name was Eileen, Aunt Eileen, as I knew her, a jolly, cheerful, happily boisterous woman whose kindness was infectious. The house was, and still is, a beautiful little cottage, refurbished and rebuilt into a home that my sister still lives in to this day. I remember being at my sister's house, laying on the couch, barely able to move from the pain, vomiting, and knowing I had to get to the hospital, quickly. Something was terribly wrong, and this time I couldn't put it off, especially since I had such severe head trauma because of my accident. I was rushed to the hospital, the same one I had been in, the Victoria General, where I underwent a torrent of tests and procedures to stabilize my condition and determine what exactly was wrong with me. I'm going to pause here for a second to give you a disclaimer. Anyone who may be sensitive to imagery associated with surgeries, injuries, medical procedures, or the anatomy, you may want to fast forward, since in the following segments I'll be detailing specific injuries, surgical descriptions, medical procedures that may be too graphic for the sensitive listener. After numerous x-rays and exploratory tests, it was discovered that because of my accident, when my head hit the ground with a loud crack, the right side of my head, the impact had fractured my skull, breaking my skull, leaving a hole in my upper right eye socket on the inner side of my skull. A hole, the doctor said, that was so big he could fit his thumb through. Apparently, because where the hole was in my skull, also because of brain swelling, the hole went undetected in the initial x-rays or CT scans. As a result, brain fluid was leaking through the hole and forming an abscess, a pocket of fluid, at the front of my brain the size of a golf ball. The abscess was now so big that it was pressing against my brain, causing the severe, increasingly intense headaches, and causing me to vomit. My life went from bad to worse in the blink of an eye. Not only did the hole in my skull, behind my eye socket, need to be repaired, the abscess also needed to be drained. Doctors couldn't repair my skull until they first drained the golf ball-sized abscess of brain fluid that had formed because of the hole. For those of you who don't know, brain fluid leaks or drains from the skull by flowing down through the nose or to the throat. Because of the newly discovered hole, my brain fluid couldn't drain properly through the nose or throat. Instead, the hole was causing the fluid to build up and collect at the front of my skull. The solution to my problem was twofold. First, the doctors had to drain the fluid so they could secondly get into my skull to repair the hole. And to repair the hole in my skull, I would have to undergo a procedure called a craniotomy, in which doctors would cut away a portion of my skull, go in, take muscle tissue from the back of my head, and plug the hole at the front that would prevent fluid from leaking through the hole. Needless to say, the solution to my problem was extremely complicated. It was also a race against time. My life, once again, hung in a state of uncertainty. Not only did I require extensive knee surgery, but I also now require 2 major life-saving brain surgeries. Throughout this podcast, the interviews, the stories of starting over, my own story, you'll hear me talk a lot about change. Change from the perspective of choice, and change when the choice is taken away. So many of us in life fear change, or are resistant to change, yet when the choice is taken away from us, and change is forced upon us, it's amazing just how much a person can handle, withstand, and survive. By resisting change, often choosing the safe and comfortable, we deny ourselves an exploration of the most amazing part of the human experience. When we have no choice but to change for our survival, our very existence, you end up going to places within yourself that you otherwise wouldn't choose to explore. And by going to those places, when you have no choice, you realize that the things you once thought you weren't capable of doing or handling, the things you once thought were impossible, are indeed truly possible. After being hit by a car, waking up from a coma, and being released from hospital, my first year of starting over was a process of discovery, the discovery of the full extent of my injuries after my accident. The injuries occurred in a cascading manner. Like I mentioned earlier, I was initially released from the hospital after 2 weeks of waking up from a coma. That short length of time of 2 weeks always seemed too good to be true. And like I said, it was. When I learned that I'd have to undergo several surgeries, I wasn't so much disappointed as I was eager to get them over with and get on with life. Between brain surgery and knee surgeries, I was looking at another year of constant recovery. When you don't have a choice in the matter, when it's live or die, the quicker you face the issue head-on, the quicker you get to the solution. The doctors did drain the abscess in my head, first, before the major brain surgery. The pocket of fluid was so big that the procedure had to be done twice. I was awake for both procedures. It was very medieval and surprisingly rudimentary and barbaric that involved a hand drill to create a hole at the front of my skull. Once the drill created the hole, doctors took a syringe and manually drained the fluid. I had this done twice, and like I said, I was awake. The doctor even showed me the fluid. Once the abscess was gone, major brain surgery followed very quickly. I'm going to save this experience for a future episode, what it was like to have brain surgery. But I'll just say that it was one of the most extreme experiences of my life. The doctors had to go into my skull, take muscle tissue from the back of my head, and repair the hole. The night before the surgery, I remember thinking to myself that I didn't even know if I'd be the same person when I woke up. I didn't even know if I'd wake up. It wasn't scary. I wasn't scared. Nervous, sure. That night, before the brain surgery, sometime in the early morning hours, I remember another feeling of deep surrender come over me. I'll never forget it. I was surrendering to what I couldn't control on the deepest level of my existence. There was nothing to fear. Fear was irrelevant because I had no control over the fear. I only had the moment. I could only control myself, right now, in this very moment, this very second. The last thing I was going to do was waste 1 second on negative emotions. I was going to enjoy every second. It was truly an amazing experience. It was an amazing choice. It's a choice we all have at our disposal. The next day, brain surgery went well as it could have. I remember waking up in the ICU with a pounding headache, a better headache, but a sense of extreme relief. I survived. I was okay. I was ready for the next few months of recovery. I spent a significant portion of my life living on the second floor of the Victoria General Hospital, their neurological floor. The next year of my life was in and out of this floor. My days were spent mostly talking with and meeting with other people who suffered some form of head trauma, from mild to severe. Again, keep in mind, I was 16. While all my friends were going to school, coming of age, I was stuck in the hospital. I was exposed to things I otherwise would never have chosen to experience. I didn't have a choice but to experience these things. I was in the hospital with people whose lives were forever changed. And although my situation was bad, there were others I saw who were much, much worse. It's through this experience of being in and out of the hospital on this floor that I learned to have deep gratitude for my condition. Although there were many times that I, myself, didn't know if I'd survive, I was deeply grateful for the moment and that I still had my ability to function, think, and communicate. I saw so many people on that floor who were permanently damaged, who lost themselves completely, and their families were now caregivers. It was heartbreaking. At the same time, I also saw amazingly courageous and resilient survivors who were permanently damaged or disfigured, but were alive and making the best of life. I met one man who lost a quarter of his skull and face, who I still think about to this day. He was amazing. If he could survive and thrive, so could I. He was a living representation of hope. In the coming months and years, I also underwent and endured eye surgery, spinal taps, other exploratory procedures. I battled meningitis, respiratory infections, liver infections, even hepatitis C. I nearly lost my life several times after my accident, where things were touch and go on many occasions. I had surgery on both my knees. My left knee was to remove cartilage, whereas my right knee was to repair the torn ACL. Back in 1985, it was a major procedure. I was forced to wear an enormous full leg cast for many weeks, walk with crutches, and I have two scars on either side of my knee as a result. One scar as a result of staples that runs the entire length of my right leg because they needed to take tissue from my leg to serve as the new ligament. Today, though, after so many years, ACL surgery has come a long way, and it's a fairly routine procedure with less scars and no need for a full cast. The ACL surgery left me with a slight but permanent limp. As I've said in both Part 1 and Part 2 of this series, I'm also fascinated by how this one event in my life was seen and felt by others in my life. My accident, recovery, and coma was also seen and experienced from multiple perspectives, including the perspective of my best friend, Doug, who I spent most of my time with in and out of school. We've known each other since we were 6 and 7 years old. One of the most comforting things to me while I was in hospital, and one of the things I'm most grateful for in life, still to this day, was the fact that Doug would bike down to the hospital every day to see me. We lived on the outskirts of the city, in a new subdivision that was far from the downtown core, where the Victoria General Hospital was, and still is to this day. Although I had many people come to visit me in the hospital, many friends who I'm grateful for, Doug would make the special effort to see me almost every day. He'd come to the hospital and we'd hang out as if I was home. We'd go to the sitting room, play games, or go to the cafeteria, or even take walks outside with me pulling an IV stand along beside me. Hopefully I can get him on the show to explore this side of the story, this turning point, from his perspective, what it was like to watch his best friend start over, and what it taught him at such a young age. He was forced to witness his friend start over. It's not like he had a choice either. His support back then, his friendship, to this day is everything to me. I got hit by a car near the end of grade 10, my first year of high school. As a result of my accident, my injuries, the many surgeries I'd have to face, my recovery, I spent 5 years in high school. Most people spend 3, some 4. This was one of the toughest aspects of my recovery. I couldn't keep pace with my peers. Like I mentioned in Part 1, there were circumstances in my life that made me feel less than others. I was forced to spend 5 years in high school, which amplified those feelings of being less than others. There was a sense of shame and inadequacy that came with my high school years, a feeling that I wasn't good enough, that I was a loser because I spent 5 years in high school while others were getting on with their lives. Of course that wasn't the case, but I couldn't help but feel like a loser. When you look around at your school and you're the oldest person, it doesn't feel good. People look at you differently. All throughout my recovery, my goal was to get to university, whatever it took. Whatever I had to do in high school, I couldn't be left behind as a result of my accident. The big goal prior to my accident was to get into university. I couldn't allow that dream to be a casualty of my accident. Thankfully, I had a guidance counselor at high school, Mr. Muhammad, who went to bat for me with the university I had applied to in my final year. I had spent so much time in and out of the hospital during high school that some of my lower marks didn't accurately reflect my academic aptitude. Mr. Muhammad negotiated my acceptance into university because he knew that I had gotten a raw deal because of my accident, that I shouldn't be held back from university or post-secondary education over something beyond my control. While many of my friends were already in university, that same university, I'm not sure if people truly understood what getting accepted into university meant to me. It meant that I had caught up. It meant that I wasn't a loser for spending 5 years in high school. It meant that I was their equal. It meant that my accident didn't hold me back. Like I also mentioned in part one of this series, I was losing my family at the same time. My parents were going through a nasty divorce at the very moment I got hit by a car. They had previously been together my entire life. I had a safe home to go to each day. When I got out of the hospital, the next few months to years, I remember bouncing around from my father's place with his new wife, to my mother's new apartment, to my sister's place outside the city, even to my football coach's home for a while. I had lost the stability and structure of my family unit and was forced to start over. And then suddenly, within an instant, because of my accident, I had lost everything I knew of myself, my home, and my identity. My entire life was reset and my identity wiped clean. I was starting over from a level of identity at my core. This was all happening to me at 16, between the ages of 16 and 21. Even thinking about it now, as I say these words, it's mind-boggling what I went through. Suddenly I was on top of the world, playing sports year-round, had gone from the unpopular kid to the popular kid, all the pain that went along with being bullied, to finally having cheerleaders calling your name. All of it was gone in the blink of an eye. I was starting over. My 5 years of recovery were a constant, ongoing process of letting go. At 16, most people are hanging on to their identity, building upon that identity, being cool, being someone, building confidence. Most people at 16 are forming lifelong associations and relationships that create the foundation for their personal and professional identities. Between high school and university, we lay the foundation of our identities. I didn't have that luxury. I was forced to let my identity go at a time when identity meant everything to everyone else. Looking back now, though, I have to say with all honesty and sincerity, and I've felt this way for a long, long time, my accident, my coma, my recovery was the best thing that ever happened to me. During those 5 years of recovery, I got to understand truly who I was as a person on the deepest level of being and mortality. In what is the most profoundly significant residual from my accident, I get to experience life from a perspective of knowing who I was when I had everything, and then knowing exactly who I was when I had nothing and my life was wiped clean. Like many in life, prior to my accident, so much of my identity was invested in material things or superficial things, like the clothes you wear, the music you listen to, your fashion, your haircut, your car, the sports you play. So many material things to make you look cool and fit in with others. In many ways, investing in those items for your identity is a way of deflecting from truly inhabiting who you really are as a person. When I was hit by a car, I was forced to let all of those things go and start fresh. Suddenly, I was different. Suddenly, I lost everything. Suddenly, I didn't fit in. Suddenly, I was held back. I was forced to experience life without those things to build a new identity. My 5-year recovery journey led me to a new crossroads in life that would see me let go of everything I knew for a second time and start over again as a young adult after university. It was this crossroads where my life truly began. Stay tuned for the next episode of Starting Over Drive Turning Points called My Life at a Crossroads, in which I detail life immediately after my recovery. The new conflict I was forced to confront for my future, the lowest point after my accident, my shattered self-confidence, confronting my fate, the challenge of settling versus taking action on my future, staring into the unknown, and this time choosing to transform my life rather than being forced to change, especially since I was already a changed person. Also stay tuned for future episodes in this series called What It's Like to Be Blind in One Eye, the impact of brain surgery on my life, and how my accident was the best thing that ever happened to me. Thanks for listening to the Starting Over Drive podcast. Join us next time for another real story of starting over. In the meantime, make sure to follow us on Spotify, YouTube, Amazon, Stitcher, and all major podcasting platforms. Head to the Starting Over Drive Facebook page, follow us on Twitter subscribe to our channels, help us grow, and feel free to share your story of starting over, or even let us know if you relate to any of the issues touched upon in our interviews. You can also find us at the Starting Overdrive podcast at the official site, www.startingoverdrive.com.